Hello and welcome to Journey Through History for Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022. Tonight's discussion is of the novel The Diamond Eye, written by historic fiction writer Kate Quinn.
Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Books. Our guest today is Kate Quinn, author of The Diamond Eye, published by HarperCollins and just released. Kate is the best-selling author of the Empress of Rome series, The Borgia Chronicles, The Alice Network, which is my wife's favorite, The Huntress, and The Rose Code. The Diamond Eye chronicles the life and times of Mila Pavlyuchenko, Lady Death, a World War II sniper for the Soviet Union and really Ukraine and Russia, which is quite prescient. With over 300 kills to her record, she's feared by some, scorned by others, simply for being a woman, and used by a government that needs propaganda to rally an army and nation that is being pummeled by Hitlerites. After becoming a national heroine, she's shuffled off to the USA, a task perhaps more daunting than stalking the Nazi high command. Based on a true story, and I highly recommend Mila's own memoir, which Kate relied on a good part as a gloss on this work, or vice versa. In our country, she hobnobs with celebrity from Eleanor Roosevelt to Charlie Chaplin and Laurence Olivier. She's constantly tortured by a real pain in the ass husband. She shows herself to be a strong, moral, loving, and funny woman in a man's world. Hers is a story that is strangely current in a world that now resonates in many ways with the world Mila lived in. So welcome, Kate, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So indulge me and my listeners with a bit of a primer, especially given your honest and enlightening author's notes at the end of your works.
Well, as far as historical fiction goes, I see it as it's a companion art to, you know, being an actual historian. I would never call myself a historian. I'm a storyteller first and foremost. But the wonderful thing about historical fiction is that it can enlighten parts of history that a historian really can't touch. You know, when you are a historian, you need to take a side. You need to be, you know, forthright about, well, history leaves a gap here, so we do not know what happened. As a novelist, you have the leeway of being able to conjecture, to guess, to, you know, decide, all right, well, what if? And that can lead us to some amazing places. So I tend to think of historical fiction as being a way to prime people's interest in history, because so often history is taught to be taught the wrong way, frankly. It's taught as a dull, dry, boring list of dates and events and laws. And what people miss, especially young people, is that the past is, you know, all about people who feel the same things as we do. They're motivated by the same basic human urges. And once you start seeing that history really just is this gorgeously colored mess of human emotion, human action, human folly, then you can start to relate to the past so that it becomes more than just, you know, that list of boring, dull dates that you had to memorize for a test. So I always like to think that good historical fiction will send people down the rabbit hole, reading more to find out what it is that really happened and what did not, which is why I do rely very much in the author note to try to help people parse, this is what was real, this is what was fictional. Now go forth and look up more on your own. Well, it is that line of, you know, where is it, where is what is fictionalized and what is true? It's always a little bit of a gray area for historical authors, you know, because we're sort of playing on that line all the time. And it is a great deal of fun, you know, when you can look at something like Lyudmila Pavlyuchenko's memoir, as I did, and find things that were absolutely stranger than fiction. Things that, you know, the average historical author would not dare make up. The things that make it into the book and you think, no one's ever going to believe that that really happened, but it did.
I know, I kept going back and forth. But it is funny how it was. Your book is kind of prescient because here we are with Ukraine and Russia. And it reminded me of the old man with the pipe, Vartanov, because his views about Russia were exactly the same as Ukrainians' views about Russia today.
Yes, it's one of those things where I just read another ARC of a book that's going to be coming out not long from now. It's called The Memory Keeper of Kyiv. And that is about the famine that Ukraine was put through, which was a man-made famine where Stalin essentially starved much of the country quite deliberately. Mila is a little bit different because she was a city girl, and in the cities, you know, communism had a stronger hold. So she was more of a believer. And so I had to take that because that's what the real woman did believe. She was Ukrainian. She fought her battles on Ukrainian soil in defense of Ukrainian people. And what I've been very proud to see is that Ukraine has very much claimed her as one of their national heroines. Anytime you see an article online about, oh, Lady Death, the famous Russian sniper, you will always see a comment in the comment string of someone saying she was Ukrainian, not Russian. And you know, they're correct. She fought for the Red Army, but she was Ukrainian. And her country has claimed her for one of their own, for which I'm very proud and glad that they did. That if she were alive today, she would absolutely be one of the people, civilians that we have seen, we have read about, that we have, you know, seen pictures of, who are doing their fight for Zelensky against invading Russian troops. I do believe she would be right there on that front line.
I know. And it's funny because when I recently read about how the Ukrainians have killed 11 Russian generals, I could just imagine her, you know, wrapped
in her
head.
You could easily see her with her sniper rifle on a rooftop somewhere. And yeah, she would be probably picking generals off.
You know, if we talk about her husband, who in her memoirs just granted a couple of lines, but who figures very prominently in this book and is constantly a pain in the butt, like I said, I tried to find good qualities about him, but the only one was the one that Mila said, that he was a brilliant surgeon and saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. But then, like, Kitsenko, well, I don't want to get into any spoilers, but Mila suspects for a while that maybe he isn't that great of a surgeon with regard to one person.
Ah, well, you know, the thing about her husband, because Lady Death had a rather difficult love life early in life. You know, she was a teenage mother. She got pregnant at a very young age. And it's all we know about that first husband, because she says very little about him, but she says very little in a way that is very telling. When a woman says the only line about her ex, the ex-husband that she gives him is, "Fortunately, my son is nothing like his father." And I just thought, wow, there is a world behind that single word, "fortunately." You know that there's some very bad feeling there. And her revenge really is that she cut him completely out of her memoir. She did not want to give him, you know, the time of day, much less any space in that memoir more than she had to. And so that's what I felt gave me the liberty to be able to paint him up a little bit more and, you know, have him fill a little bit more of a role, because, you know, he undoubtedly did, you know, loom large in her life. It's just she decided not to give him that space in the only space that she could control, which was the memoir that she left for posterity. The only thing we really know about him was that we know he was somewhat older than she was. And we know that there is some indication he was a doctor. So, you know, if he was, then he almost certainly would have been made to join the Red Army as an army doctor. So I decided, well, why not make him a combat surgeon? And why not make him someone that they end up on the front together in, you know, similar battle zones, which was not totally out of the possibility. And then he continues to be a thorn in her side, as you said, but I do need a little bit more of a concrete on the ground villain, because for the most part, you know, Lady Death's enemies are going to be as just dots in her telescopic sights. And she's not going to certainly have any personal enmity toward the people that, you know, she's fighting against, because they're simply invaders. Her job is to push them back. But I did want to give her a little bit more of a personal struggle. So therefore, the fact that she had an ex-husband she had very bad feelings about just did seem to, you know, fit nicely into one of those places where a novelist could ask, what if?
And the interesting thing you did was, in the beginning, she's so meek and mild around him. But as her own personal journey progresses, she begins to have a little more chutzpah about the manner in which she deals with him, which, again, without spoilers, becomes very, very clear.
Well, it's one of those things where I wanted to give her a personal journey as well as, you know, a professional one. And for any woman who's had an abusive ex, or, you know, a bad ex, that can be the kind of thing that really leaves marks on you. And, you know, it really does leave a pattern of flinches that is very hard to grow out of. And I wanted that to be part of, you know, the growth that she does.
Hey, here's something I just thought about. Throughout the book, you're very careful to say Hitlerites, which is not a term I'm familiar with. And I always wonder, okay, why don't they just say Nazis?
Oh, well, they use that too to some degree, but Hitlerites was a term I saw continually in Soviet propaganda and in Soviet memoirs and so forth. It's a term that Mila uses in her memoir, and it's a term I've seen others use as well. So, because that term also pops up in my book, The Huntress, which is about the Night Witches, which is the Red Army women pilots. And the reason for that really was the fact that the Soviets did not believe that, they really turned their nose up at the idea of Hitler considering his particular brand of political philosophy National Socialism. They said that, you know, quite fairly, that Hitler's brand of philosophy had absolutely nothing to do with real socialism. So they called the Germans Hitlerites as a way of saying, look, you're not socialists in any way, shape, or form. You are a cult around Hitler, and that's it. So it was their way of denigrating the fact that Hitler was trying to call his particular movement in some degree socialism.
I thought a lot about cult of personality, especially when we got into Roosevelt and the fact that I've always felt so sorry that he didn't live, as she says, to see the end of the war. But it's true, you know, you think of the Yalta conference and you think, you know, Roosevelt and Churchill already hated Stalin, but they had to be with him.
Yes, and you know, that's where it was really one of those things politics makes for strange bedfellows. I am no apologist for Stalin. You know, the man was a monster. He killed so many of his own people as well as, you know, the enemy. But the fact was, it is a very plain fact that without the alliance with the Soviet Union, who knows how World War II would have fallen out. And it's something I get into in my author note, but the common sort of saw is that, you know, World War II was won with British intelligence, American steel, and Soviet blood. And that there's a kernel of truth to that. The fact is that without the Eastern Front absorbing so much of Hitler's manpower, resources, ammunition, everything, without the millions that they soaked up on that side, who knows if the Western Front could have been won, because, you know, there was so much that had to be diverted into this, you know, huge land that just kept sucking up everything that Hitler could throw at it. So it is one of those things where it's a little difficult nowadays, and even back then, to think about, you know, the Russians or the Soviets as being good guys, because the Cold War was launched so soon afterward, where very quickly Stalin became the bad guy. But when you're talking just about World War II, you have to acknowledge the role that they played in defeating Hitler and the fact that we would might be in a very different world without them. And now, for the Russians on the ground, people like Ludmilla, it's quite clear that what she believed and the propaganda they were sold was that the only reason Stalin allied with Hitler was to buy time for an invasion he knew was coming. And that's what she would have believed, because that's what they would have been told. And we've seen firsthand how Russian propaganda, even now, continues to have a real stranglehold on what the national populace is informed.
It's funny, you mentioned propaganda twice. And then I thought of the juxtaposition of what you write and then the guy who wrote the pamphlet that she just disavowed completely, just like the photographer wanting her to be up in the tree.
She had a lot of call to interact with propagandists, you know, because she was thrust rather unwillingly into the light of being a heroine right around the time she had her, was racking up a tally up north of 250. And, you know, suddenly she was being asked, you know, pose for photos and give speeches and, you know, talk about her life. And she was not very happy about this. I mean, she said, you know, I'm just a soldier doing a job. I am not a national heroine. I don't see why you're doing this, and you're talking about it all wrong. I mean, she was very annoyed at the liberties that they took. So that was really made for some of the funnier moments in her memoir, which were a lot of fun to do, you know, where she was saying, like, why do they have me like sitting in a tree? And I wouldn't be in a tree out here anyway to make a nest. This is completely wrong. And then she talked about, you know, the fact that she was written up in a series of combat leaflets as, you know, some sort of inspirational frontline story. And the author was, you know, a popular novelist who she just apparently despised. And especially with women, there's a thing about, well, are you going to be likable enough? Because God forbid, you know, a female not be likable in the public eye. You have to be likable. People have to like you. And that was something she encountered in America as well, where one of the first things that was said to her was, you know, like, well, I don't know if the American public will find you likable if they understand that, you know, you can see the faces of the people you kill through your sights. And she's having to explain that you do realize this is a war, right? Where does my being likable come into this? And, you know, that was a real frustration for her, dealing with both press on her own side and, you know, press in America. Yes, and that was really the speech that made her famous in Chicago, where, you know, this little 5'4" Russian woman stood up there in her uniform and just said, "Gentlemen, I am 26 years old and I have taken out 309 Nazis. Don't you think, gentlemen, that you have been hiding behind my back too long?" And that challenge she just threw down, and there's a moment of silence, and then she got a standing ovation.
Two things. So one was, did someone really ask her what color underwear she wore?
Yes. It was her first press conference, and a photographer literally asked her. There were a whole series of questions that she copied out verbatim. One being like, what's her makeup routine? Could she wear lipstick at the front? Could she take hot baths? And she was just like, what? You know, a woman journalist actually asked her, you know, your uniform isn't very flattering and that skirt length makes you look fat. And do you mind? And she was just like, this is what you're asking me? And then really finally, one of the coup de grace question was, there was a photographer who asked her like what kind of underwear she preferred. And she just, at that point, she just said, that is a question that you would only ask your wife or your mistress, or you will get a slap. So if you want to come close, I'm not your wife or your mistress. So if you want to come closer, I will give you a slap. And it does appear that there was a certain amount of catcalling after that. And, you know, the guy did back down. But yes, she was asked amazingly asinine questions by the press. There are things we can empathize with as human beings, like mothers having to say goodbye to their children and leave them to do a job. And women who are listening to having to keep a smile on their face and be polite while they're hearing absolutely stupid questions about their lives from people. And these are the things that are more universal human experiences. So I wanted to pull those out so that even if this woman seems like she's a bit of a larger than life figure, that, you know, it's like she's not. There are these moments that are so intensely human that we can all empathize.
Because did that really happen? Did she really fall out of the canoe? Did Eleanor Roosevelt really hem her pajamas? Is that...
Yeah, that actually came right from her memoir, where there was a few wonderful scenes with Eleanor Roosevelt that were so good that I knew I had to include them. One being when Eleanor gave her a ride in her little convertible to a dinner party in Washington, D.C., because they ran out of seats in like the embassy car. And, you know, literally a woman with the nickname of Lady Death, you can guess is not scared of very much, is clutching the door as Eleanor Roosevelt is like bulleting through Washington, D.C. and is thinking, oh my God, this woman is a lunatic. Slow down, slow down. And as they're talking about policy and how they're going to, you know, present her at the party. And that was one I loved. And then another one was the way that Eleanor played tour guide to her on part of her driving her tour through the Midwest and through the heartlands, and was, you know, pointing out the countryside. And Ludmilla ended up falling asleep in this bulletproof limousine with like her head on the first lady's shoulder. And I've read a lot about Eleanor, and she really did have a gift for being able to reach across incredible divides. You know, she herself being a woman of great privilege and birth and money and stature. And she really did have a gift for being able to reach past that and over that to make connections with people who were very unlike her. History gave me, and I knew that would be my very last scene, because these two women did know each other, and we do know they had a chance to meet in the 1950s, and they hadn't seen each other for something like 15 years. And it is recorded that when this, at this time it was reversed, Eleanor came to the Soviet Union to, you know, on a goodwill tour of her own. And she did look Ludmilla up, and the two of them at first, you know, were sort of hemmed in by, you know, NKVD people and various minders and guards, you know, and that was a little awkward. But then they finally had the opportunity to really meet. And it is recorded that they absolutely fell into each other's arms with hugs. And, you know, I can't believe it's been so long. And they went to Ludmilla's apartment and they sat down and had a good old chat.
A fun scene was when they were both in America, and they would as a game, spot where the snipers would be. Or no, they actually spotted them.
Yeah, well, it's something that I have seen people do, because I'm a Navy wife, my husband's active duty Navy. I've known a lot of military men and women, both current and former military, and especially the ones who have been in combat, there's a stamp and you can see it. And that's the fact where they do come out on balconies and they're immediately doing this. It's like, well, where are the places that somebody would shoot you from? And they will. If they go into a strange place, they want to sit with their backs to the wall so that nobody can come up behind them. And they're the ones who immediately, whenever they walk into a new place, they know they are automatically looking where the exits are, because these are the things that people who have been in combat do. It's a very hard habit to break. So I was kind of wanting to tip my hat to that, because it is something I've seen so often in people who have been in combat zones. She met Charlie Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, who lived nearby. And it was this whole Hollywood party. Now, she did meet Laurence Olivier, although had it happen at the same party for ease. It may not have actually happened until she went to England afterward, later on the tour. But she did meet Laurence Olivier. And that actually was, the result of that was that there is an absolutely wonderful photograph that I found. I wasn't able to include it in the book because I didn't know who it belonged to. And I wasn't able to ask permission of whoever it was who owned it for the rights. But the photo is of her and Laurence Olivier. And you have this woman who's standing there in her uniform, looking uncomfortable. And he is a head taller, and he is smoldering down at her with like everything that he's got. And you can tell he's thinking, I definitely got a shot here. And, you know, the look on her face, and you can tell she's absolutely thinking, you know, buddy, if you do not, you know, like you put that, slide that hand any lower, you are going to be drawing back a stump. So I just thought, that's, again, too good not to include. So that went in. One other thing that I didn't really have the room to put in, but she also at some point must have met Woody Guthrie, or he listened
to he actually
at least heard her speak, because he wrote a song about her called Miss Pavlichenko, which you can find on YouTube.
What's next? Are you still going to stay in that area of the era and that place, or are you moving on to a different milieu?
Well, it's going to be something a little different for my next one, which is tentatively titled The Briar Club, and which is post-war, actually. It takes place in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s, and it is sort of delving into the Cold War, McCarthyism, the Red Scare, all of that.
So thanks so much for joining us today. This was a lot of fun.
No, thank you for having me. This has been a fun discussion.
Thanks for attending. You have been listening to a discussion of The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn. Remember to check back in December for my latest historic fiction selection.
Okay, folks, everybody can unmute.
Right, I've unmuted. We'll begin the discussion. It is about 23 minutes after the hour. That gives us 27 minutes. I'm sorry. That gives us 37 minutes to have a discussion. That should give everybody a chance to talk. I will call on each of you and ask you for your opinion. After you can.
Pardon?
Did you say something? I thought somebody said something.
Well, David, that was I was trying to record that song, and I have a new computer. We didn't manage, but she was in San Francisco. I think when he did write, and he sings that song. About 2 minutes, not that.
Do you have it? If you'd like Brad to play it, I have no problem.
No, I don't have it. Or I would have. I'm sorry. I wore out Google trying to get it with my new computer.
Okay. I started to use the instrumental version of the Ukrainian national anthem. That's the tiny scrap of music you heard at the beginning. And I was going to put some at the end, but I was having gold wave issues. I had some trouble with this presentation, but luckily everything sounded okay. So I guess what we should do now is begin our discussion. Brad, did you have something to say? I'm going to go down the list. There's me. I liked the book personally, though I thought the thing with the sniper was a little bit contrived. You know, the sniper who's after her in America. But it does give the book that tension she likes to put in her novels. So it wasn't a bad thing necessarily. And the history was certainly worth reading. And as always, her author's notes are really good. I always read those first. So if you have anything to say, Brad.
You calling on me, Brad?
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed the book. Like you said, the author's notes, I wish I had read those first, but at the same time, I kind of like to do things linearly. And so there might have been some things in there that spoiled something. But, you know, I'm still undecided what I think of historical fiction. It's fiction, but it certainly was based on a lot of the truth. So, again, that's where the author's notes came in. I found it an enjoyable story. I found the part, a lot of the parts where she's in the United States a little far-fetched. But once I read the author's notes, I know she had some gaps to fill. And there were a lot of things that weren't addressed in Mila's memoir. So she needed to use a little creative license there. But all in all, I found the book very enjoyable. And I'm interested in hearing what other people think as well.
Well, that's good to hear. Historic fiction to me is sort of the rocket ship that takes off from the realm of history and brings you to different places that are next door to history. It allows you sometimes to learn about something. Now, people who might never have heard of Ludmila Pavlyuchenko might want to go read her memoir now. I think the idea that Russian blood combined with British intelligence and American steel when World War II was definitely accurate, that if they had not been tying up the Eastern Front and taking horrible casualties, I think Russia lost 20 million people in that war. The 20 million casualties, I'm not sure if that included wounded. And then many people were sent to the Gulag because Stalin, if you had been a prisoner of war, to him, you should have died. What a really, really dark period in their history. The next person on my list is Alan.
Yeah, my only complaint about everything is that I didn't have enough time to finish this book. I'm going to finish it, but I've been extremely busy with some HOA stuff where I'm a treasurer. But I'm 58% of the way through. Yeah. Anybody that's ever been in a book group meeting with me knows I love strong women characters, and I really like the way she wrote Mila, and I really like Mila because she got the job done. And my favorite line in the whole book wasn't anything they mentioned in the interview you played. It's the part in 1942 when she's in America and somebody asked her stupidly, which apparently she got a lot of that, was she very surprised by the speed of American trains that took her down to Washington? And she comes back with, no, I was more surprised by the sign that I saw that said whites only in a country that supposedly was created that all men are created equal. Ouch. So, but I really like it. I'm just sorry that I hadn't been able to finish it yet, but I intend to. So thanks for picking this. It's an excellent story.
I'm glad you liked it then.
Yeah. Robert, very much.
Bob, you're next. Bob Acosta.
Okay, I'm going to be brief. There's a lot of people behind me. Great book. I like historical fiction. It's speculation. Who knows? You know, and an author has the right, in my opinion, to do what he can. Yes, there'll be gaps. Absolutely. I think she made every effort to bring out the truth. But when she didn't, she added her own thoughts, her own speculation. That's what it is. And I like the underwear story with the press. Our presses, they're idiots. But remember, we didn't like the Russians, remember? Even, you know, while, and I've never heard Hitlerites before. I understand now why she did it, used it. That was most interesting. I caught that too. But on the whole, I'm going to say it was a fine book. Russians really took their hit. And in Yalta, Roosevelt was a dying man. He tended to side with Stalin, I'm sorry to say, against Churchill. But Churchill was right when he warned us in a speech in Missouri later about the Iron Curtain. And, you know, he was right. Thank you. I'm done.
All
All right, Don, you're next.
Okay. Speaking of the Russians, I'm on a paratransit approval thing, and there's a guy who is a Russian veteran, and they have meetings weekly at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. I was really surprised, Russian army people, but that's had nothing to do with. But I found this a very interesting book. There's a lot written on it, and she really had a lot of guts getting out there to went to school, and she became a teacher, taught history. So she had quite a history.
She definitely did, as did some of her friends. I like the scene in Odessa on the day war was declared. People were at the beach and they were enjoying their time in Odessa, which some people hadn't realized Ukraine has had that city, you know, the resort of Odessa. And it just went to show you, you know, how people are people, no matter where they are. People like to have a day at the beach. Next, Jana Luttrell, I think.
Jana. Hi. I did like this book. A couple of things that struck me that are very obvious, but they still kind of made me think. And one was counting the number of kills. I mean, I realize that's what snipers do, but that's just so barbaric. And I just kept thinking, oh my God, 250 now. Oh my goodness, 300 now. And I mean, again, that's stating the obvious because war is barbaric. But, and then the way that she was treated by the journalists was pointed out, I think, very, very well. And also the, I think we tend to think of the Russians in such a dark way. And now we sort of know this in the United States that good people can have terrible leaders. Okay. She was just a good, basically a good person with a horrible, horrible leader. And that's really all I have to say.
I wonder if her son is still alive. I don't know if the author said that and what he would be like now. He'd be very old. But I guess we don't know. Joni's telephone is unmuted. I don't know if she can talk.
I think she didn't communicate.
She's muted. I think she's eating.
She's at dinner.
She told me, I don't like speaking for people, but she told me okay. She doesn't like books.
Here I am. That. I'm here.
Oh, there she is. Okay, Joni, I'll let you do your own talking.
Hi. I have to say that I read this book, I read 4 hours of it, and I really don't like war and battles. I thought she was wonderful from what I read about her, and I admire, I guess I shouldn't say this, but I guess I admire a sniper that can, I mean, I hate killing, but I admire somebody that can just point a gun and get them if they're bad. So I only read the book. I only read 4 hours. I would have liked it if all the war stuff was taken out, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I really wanted to know. I mean, if I could have had a very abridged, maybe one page version to know how things came out for her. I did read in the beginning when she met Eleanor Roosevelt, and so anyway, that's what I have to say.
Yeah,
don't have too many more war books. I don't like war.
I was planning not to. We've done two in the past year, and I've had enough of World War II. I was hoping to go and find something really exotic from, say, the 15th or 16th century. I want us to do something out of this sort of past 100 years.
And they had wars then too.
Yes, but not quite as severe. But I don't want it to be a war book. I would like to have a book about maybe a discovery, or I have one right now, but it's too long. It's called To the Ends of the Earth by Michael Talbot, and it tells the 8-month journey from England to Australia, but it's 28 hours long. So I don't think I'll do that to you, but it has no war in it. It's beautifully written. Norman Barrs narrates it beautifully, but it's old. But I'll keep looking. And I do take Joni's point. Let me see. I think LaDon is next, or is it Betsy? Wait, Betsy, I think, is next.
Can you hear me okay? I've got internet issues.
Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Except for the sexual scenes, I loved the storyline. It kept me fascinated. I couldn't wait to read the next bit of it each day. And I also enjoyed just the way the author kept you in suspense enough to keep you going, and how she made Ludmilla very realistic. And even though she took a lot from the memoirs too, but I mean, she just made her, you could just picture her trying to do some of those sniping incidents that she had to do and the struggle she went through to prove herself. So I really enjoyed the book, like I said, except for some of the scenes in it.
Well, great. I think LaDon is next. It's looking like some of these are moving around. Alan, do these things move around? I thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
They do. Based on how people are muted or not muted, changes the order and stuff. So
I'm going to do my best. If I miss somebody, holler at me. LaDon, you're next.
Okay. Yes, I am a fan of historical fiction, and I thought this was a very good book. I've read a number of books set in World War II. And this is the first time I found myself in the Russian army, looking at the war from the Russian point of view. And I thought it was interesting. I guess it happens in every army and every time, how the women were pressured to give sexual favors, you know, to the officers. And I thought that was interesting. I thought this article, this interview today with the author was one of the better ones you played to introduce the programs. It was very interesting. When I read the part about the end of the book in the park, I knew that was fictionalized. I didn't believe that at all. And when I went back to see the author's note, I see that the husband, rather than being killed there in the park, was probably in actuality killed in action somewhere in Russia somewhere. They don't know exactly. But I thought I like historical novels because it gives you the insight into people that history alone doesn't do, you know. And it's all, I like it, depends on the author. Do they stick close to the facts, or do they make a lot of stuff up? And I thought she did a pretty good job sticking fairly close to the facts and only moved one or two events and here and there and that. And then, of course, made up that last part in the park. But you, when you're reading that, you knew that that was fictionalized, but that's okay. It was a story, and it built to crescendo, or however you ever say that word, in the end. And it was very interesting. And once again, I like to say that the author interview that you played before the program was one of the better introductions we've had to these historical meetings. And I like that. So thanks for the book, and thanks for letting me speak about it.
Great. Glad to do. And I was glad to find this. I had found another podcast, but it wasn't as well done as this one. When I heard this one, I knew this was the one. And I didn't want to string together two or three different things, because I've done that in the past and it can get messy. I believe the next person is Kathy Snyder.
Okay. Well, I like the beginning of the book and I could hardly put it down. And then I got real bored when it came to the whole Washington, D.C. thing. I didn't like the ending. I thought it was stupid. But I enjoyed the beginning, and I couldn't, like I said, and then I was just disappointed by how long and drawn out and how it dragged at the end. But the part where the author puts in the at the very end, as Brad mentioned, and some of you, the rest of y'all have mentioned, where the author kind of explains who Ludmila was and all of this and her real life and who her husbands might have been. Then I was like, oh, yeah, there's probably not a whole lot of information on her. And if she was smart when she wrote her book for Stalin, then she kind of fudged as much as she could fudge. But I didn't have any idea about this lady or that there were female snipers. I knew that there were female soldiers in the Soviet army, but I enjoyed reading it, even though I didn't like the ending. So that's it.
Well, great. Thank you. I believe, Sherry, you are up.
Okay. I agree with a lot of what everybody else has already said. One of the things I really liked was the little bit of trivia about being a sniper, like the fact that she could bury a bottle of water next to her with a tube up to her ear and feel the vibrations when the convoy was approaching. I thought that was just a fascinating little bit of trivia. Pre-technology, you know, that you had these little gimmicks that you would use. I thought the friendship between her and Eleanor Roosevelt was really good. It seemed realistic because it started out slow. She didn't really trust her or have any respect for her, and that kind of grew over time. The one thing I kind of was confused at the end is you have this sniper setting up his gun to shoot Franklin Roosevelt, and she ends up tussling with him and stabbing him, and he takes off running. Wouldn't somebody have found his gun that he left behind, or this little rifle stand or whatever? I thought that she kind of left that out, and that was kind of unrealistic. But of course, like someone else said, the whole ending was a little bit unrealistic, but certainly dramatic and certainly held your attention. And I agree that the interview that you played was really excellent and interesting. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. I believe Lynn Evans is next.
Yeah, I'm here. I definitely like the book. I'm still struggling with the historical fiction books. Because I get into the book sometimes and I don't know what's fiction and what's fact. And I think earlier someone had mentioned that they kind of look for the section of the book at the back of the book where the author talks about, you know, the historical facts about the book, which I don't ever do because for whatever reason, when I start reading a book, I start at the beginning. I don't do any jumping around until and then I get to the end of the book. So I think next time we have a historical fiction book, I think I will probably go jump around to see if I can find that one section where the author talks about the historical facts of the book. Because I've read past books. I'm starting to like the genre. I'm not sure that, you know, if I was going to pick a book out on my own of historical fiction, you know, where I would begin to try to pick out something good. My favorite part of this book was, Eleanor Roosevelt, and she's hemming up the pajamas. I thought that was a hoot. I liked it. I liked when they fell out of the canoe. That I thought that was pretty cool too. The ex-husband, what a jerk. I'm glad that he got his comeuppance at the end of the book. You know, what a jerk. I think I would have liked to have more interaction, if it was possible, through letters with her son. But I know she was sending him leaves. But you know, if they had included a couple of letters, correspondence letters or something like that, I think that would have been. That would have been interesting to me. Basically, I like the book. As for the sex scenes, it wasn't too risque. It was there. And she seemed to have she seemed to fall in love with her sidekicks, her partners. And maybe that's the kind of a bad thing to do if you're in if you're in a war, but to keep falling in love with your partners. But I guess that couldn't have been helped. But I enjoyed it. It was a good book, good read. And I definitely what I like about this particular what I like is the first 20 to 30 minutes when you have the interview with the authors. I think, you know, that really, if I'm going to tune in for anything, I don't want to miss the first 30 minutes. thanks for listening to me. And I hope I didn't drag on too long.
Oh, that was fine. Did we hear from Mary Ellen already?
No.
Go ahead. And then Michelle, you'll be after. And I think there's a Mary R.
Okay, I'm Mary Ellen. I almost didn't finish. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I almost did not finish the book because of the violence, but thank heavens for treadmills. So I said to myself, every time you get on the treadmill, read this book. So I got through that and really, really ended up loving this book. And I think that, you know, a scene that nobody's mentioned, even in the interview, and the interviewer could have stood with some elocution lessons. I think that a really sad scene was when she fell, the guy that she really, really loved was killed, and his best friend took her out of the hospital on leave, and they went and they got drunk, and she came to terms with it and then was able to get back in the field. And of course they sent her to Moscow. But after the, you know, they got her to Moscow, I just couldn't put the book down, and I really, really liked it.
Well, great.
So that's it.
I believe Michelle is next. Les.
Sure. One of my favorite narrators is Saskia Maribel, and she was the one who narrated the book. So I was very glad to listen to her. I think she's a really excellent narrator, really good with accents. And she does a lot of historical fiction, and I've heard her quite a few times read historical fiction. I actually did not like this book very much at all. I read the whole thing. I liked the second half much, much better than the first half. I don't think I like to read about wartime. I'll amend that. I think I don't like to read about the people that are actually fighting in the war. I like to read about wartime, but I don't like to read about the battlefields. The thing that bothered me the most about this book was at one point they mentioned that she said when she looks through, I guess, the sight of the rifle and she sees the enemy, then she could kill the person. And I'm sure that's true. But I just think that somebody that kills 309 people, no matter what the circumstances are, war, no war, whatever, has to have some sort of psychological impact from this, from all that killing. And there was no exploration in this book at all of her psychological state other than that one comment. And it was really very glaring to me when I was reading this book. I like to read about old Hollywood. The parts with Eleanor Roosevelt were really interesting. I loved the part where she was interviewed, you know, all those sexist comments, which I can imagine very, very true to life. Although I love historical fiction, this absolutely was not my kind of book. It dealt too much with the mechanics of the war, and it was extremely plot driven. There just wasn't a lot of psychological depth in the story. So I, you know, unlike most of you from listening to all your comments, I was not a fan of this book.
Well, I appreciate your honesty, and it's always good to have a couple of people in any book group who don't like the book or don't agree with the book, because you don't want everything to be a perfect five. You have to watch on Amazon if there are a bunch of fives and ones. You know that this has been a staged review, so I appreciate your honesty. I think we have one person left now. Is it Margaret R.?
Yeah.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I want to thank you. This is Margaret up in Maine. I rarely get to join you, and it's always a great privilege to be able to. I enjoyed the book tremendously.
Thank you.
And I loved it. It was very interesting to hear the interview. I think the character, this isn't really the historical part, but I think the character that actually interested me the most, because I couldn't decide if he was truly believable, was Kostya. And I think she said, I think the author said at the end that she did kind of cobble him together out of various people that she had known. And so I spent some time kind of wondering, is this person, you know, too good or too self-sacrificing to be believable? And there may be no answer to that question, but that was sort of an interesting side of it. But I did really enjoy the book, and it did feel very, very relevant. And if anyone wants to try it.
Who was Kostya? Was he the woodsman?
Oh, he was the partner. No, he was her partner.
The one they call a wolf.
Something or other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the one
the wolf,
she marries.
Yes, the Siberian.
She marries at the end. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know there are a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people to keep track. I felt bad for the woodsman because the Germans wanted his house, so they lined up everybody, shot them all, dumped them in a grave. Oh, he comes back, realizes what happened, and he does get his revenge. Revenge was a dish supposedly best eaten cold, but in this book, they didn't have time to wait, so they would get their revenge hot. Did I miss anybody?
I just wanted to add one. It's Margaret still.
Ahead.
One more thing
go
for
ahead.
Anyone who might be. I just was curious, and I looked on Bard.
Yes.
And there are actually three other books of hers.
Oh, she's
on
good.
Bard. Yeah.
I love everything she wrote.
So, if anyone wants to read something else of hers, there's stuff out there for us.
The Empress of Rome series and the Lucrezia Borgia stuff. I haven't read the Alice Network. It's World War I, and I've kind of, as you said, I'm burned out a little bit on war. I'd like to see what she's going to do in the 1950s with that book she mentioned in the 1950s.
Me too.
Whatever club, the Marlowe Club, whatever that club's name was. That should be interesting. We have about 8 minutes left. I think what we should probably do now is hand the meeting over to John Queen, who will be playing a promo or having a promo played for our next subscribe book in September. Again, I will try to find us something very different away from all this war and the history of the past 100 years. You know, I remember we did one about Pompeii. We've done one about Shakespeare's brother. We've done one set in ancient Egypt. So I'll see what I can do.
Well, you know, I had one on Egypt, on Greece.
Ooh.
I got lynched. There was too much. It was 1,000 years. It would have taken 2 semesters in college. Too much for a history book. But I think you should take a specialized area. Maybe we can play the promo for our book. We got it. Maybe our last, I don't know if it's our last book, but on church. Missing.
I knew that.
We're on the air.
Huh?
You ready for me to play the?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. Give everybody a quick mute.
You have started computer audio share.
Join us on Tuesday, September 6th. To review our second book on
Winston Churchill and his family and their England's greatest hour.
The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz, by Eric Larson. Read by John Lee and Eric Larson. Unrated. Commercial audiobook. Bestseller.
One of today's acclaimed popular historians has taken on one of history's most acclaimed figures. Eric Larson wrote a book about Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister whose inspiring speeches led the UK through World War II.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Larson's past books have often focused on less famous characters right at the edge of history, like an architect and a mass killer in Chicago, or an ambassador to Nazi Germany. The Splendid and the Vile reconstructs one year of Winston Churchill's outsized life, his most famous year, beginning in May 1940, when Churchill became prime minister just as a German attack loomed. Behind Churchill's inspiring speeches was an eccentric character. At times, he would lash out at his staff. He could be angry one moment and jolly the next. And in the midst of war, Larson says Churchill even had a playful side.
At the Prime Ministerial Country Home Chequers, one evening, actually, after one of these fabulous dinners there, Churchill, in his blue siren suit, which is a pale blue one-piece suit that made him honestly look like an Easter egg, in the siren suit, but also in his flaming gold red dragon dressing gown, he picks up a Mannlicher rifle with a bayonet. There is martial music playing on the gramophone, and he proceeds to do bayonet drills in front of all his guests in the Great Hall at Chequers.
As one does.
As one does, actually, yes.
Larson says he wanted to reconstruct how the UK endured. Churchill became prime minister at a moment when Germany was about to carry out a prolonged and devastating aerial bombing campaign. How did Churchill keep people's spirits up during those 57 nights?
That is part of the magic, I think, of Churchill. The fundamental element was that he was acutely aware of the power of symbolic acts. Symbolic acts, for example, walking among the homes that had been destroyed by bombers, talking to the public, making himself visible and being visibly moved. Symbolic acts, for example, when raids occurred, he would more than likely go to the roof of the nearest building to watch the raid. And he'd bring staff up to the roof and watch this thing unfold, and he made it known that this was happening. So a lot of little symbolic acts. And, of course, the speeches. You know, the speeches were heroic, but also he was very aware that he had to provide a sober assessment of the reality. And I think that was very, very important. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, we're going to get through this. This is not going to be a problem. But, you know, you've got a populace that's just been through 57 nights of bombing and is now undergoing raids on a more extended period that are growing worse and worse and will continue through the following spring. You've got a populace that is rather prone to be skeptical and does not want to be told happy truths. But he had this way of balancing the happy truths with this absolute heroic conviction. He never indicated even an ounce of doubt as to what the ultimate victory was going to be.
Never doubt, and yet in his speeches he'll repeatedly say, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. This is going to be awful. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better at all.
Exactly. And yet that was exactly what he needed to say, because people understood. They understood they had to steel themselves. Had he just said, you know, don't worry about it, this is a passing thing, you know, we've got this under control, I firmly believe it would not have helped, would not have worked.
Eric Larson is the author of The Splendid and the Vile, among many other books. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz, by Eric Larson. DB100054. Read by John Lee and Eric Larson. DB100054.
Alan, did we read this for your group a while ago?
March 16th, 2021.
Right, because I was sitting there going, did we read this for the history group? But I think we
No, Worlds of Books, March 16th, 2021.
Sounded so familiar.
It's a really good book. And for people that don't like war, there's a lot about his family and stuff in there, too.
Right, right.
But, is there a lot of war in it?
Not really. It's mostly about how he deals with the Blitz. There's some stuff about the Blitz, so there's some bombing stuff. But it's kind of interesting to learn how people dealt with that and how brave people were. But there's a lot about his family in there.
Anyway. Oh,
that sounds good. Well, Eric Larson, didn't he write a book about the Lusitania?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dead
Wake.
Yeah.
And that was so good.
Devil in the White City.
He's a good author.
He's great.
Excellent. Right. Anyway. Yeah.
Excellent.
Can't go wrong.
There's very little war. There's a lot of destruction and death in it from the... Yeah, London took a terrible toll on it. So I never realized quite how 40,000 people. But it's good. It's about Mary and you want to get married, and they stopped her. Watch the clock.
Anyway, great job on tonight's discussion, David, and the interview and stuff. You did an excellent job, so thanks.
Sure did.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah, thanks, David.
All right, guys. Y'all take care. I'm gone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Come to Fictional New Friday night. You know, we're doing.
I'll be there.
Good luck. See y'all then. Take care.
It'll be a good one.
It's kind of an interesting start.
Take care, Al.
All right.